Today's date is August 28, 1997. Speaker is Peter Cohan. The topic is God in the Details. Why less is more and more is less.
My name is Peter Cohan. I'm an architect in Seattle. I have an office on a houseboat on Portage Bay, if any of you are from Seattle. I also teach architecture at the university. I have my university job is two-thirds time officially, and my architecture job is dependent upon how much work I have at the time, but I sort of have two full-time jobs is what it amounts to. But I love doing what I do. I love teaching people about architecture and doing architecture. I've never taught architecture to laymen before. When Nancy asked me to come and do some sessions up at the Village this summer, I wasn't quite sure how to approach it and why I should be teaching about architecture up here in the first place. I guess the conclusions I came to were several. One, that Holden Village should be about all of the activities that we do and how our lives touch the whole world. And I think architecture is part of that. I wanted to share my enthusiasm for architecture with you. And I wanted to try and make all of you more aware of how important architecture is. I think when we look at buildings around us today, we're dismayed by most of the newer buildings. They don't move us the way they should. Most of the spaces that we live and work in are rather mundane. And so we lose any sense that architecture can do a lot more than that. Architecture is one of the main ways that we shape our environment. And it's a cultural artifact. And as a cultural artifact, it also transmits our values. You know, the way that we feel about things is transmitted in what we build, whether we like it to or not. And I think a lot of the values that we're transmitting now are not very good ones. Architecture is an extraordinarily difficult profession, and it's a difficult task to make a good work of architecture, and that's also probably evident by how few good buildings we actually have. I won't go into a lot of the reasons for that. There are many. I think the main one is that if you think back, the buildings that we like, particularly, are usually the result of a long and continuous building tradition. Vernacular buildings, for instance. These are vernacular buildings, in a way. They were designed by an architect. But they represented a long tradition of building that made a lot of decisions about how those buildings were made very easy. The people that built them were craftsmen who understood their materials very well and how those materials went together. The programs for the buildings, the functions that went on inside them were very simple, so they could be simple buildings. And so these simple, well-made vernacular buildings set an extraordinarily high standard for architecture today, in which building technologies are continuously changing, so it's hard to really get to know them. Building programs are getting increasingly more complicated, so it's hard to make simple buildings. So in any case, the title of my talk or the session today is Ugly Ducklings, and that I was going to show you some modern buildings with beautiful interiors, beautiful spaces. I am going to do that at the end of this lecture. I'm actually going to show you one ugly duckling, and I got confirmation of that earlier today, and that's the St. Ignatius Chapel at Seattle University. But before I do that, I want to set a certain context. I want to talk a little bit about architecture in general. And I thought I would start in the simplest way possible, and that is with a room. I've included a couple of slides of rooms that have meant a lot to me, rooms that I think of when I think back of spaces that I love to be in or spaces that had a certain amount of meaning to me. And I'm sure maybe at the end of the hour, if we have time, we can come back to this and ask you about spaces that were particularly important or moving to you. But in any case, two of those spaces for me are this one, which is actually a room on the upper level of Narnia, the south-facing classroom in Narnia, which during the winter time is now used as a school. But when my mother was the potter up here in the early 80s, and that's my mother there on the left, it became the winter pot shop. And actually the interior shot, this is kind of cheating. You can see the seasons change between these two shots. But it was one of the marvelous places to be at Holden Village in the wintertime. You would trundle the path and work your way down to Narnia, and you always had to shuttle the path out occasionally. Finally come in, and there was a big wood stove in the center of the space and these huge, beautiful south-facing windows, and the potter's wheel set up in the sunshine right next to the windows. And we would come periodically in the winter, in the couple of winters that my mom was here and visitor, and I would throw pots like I do now when I come up. And it was just a splendid place to be. This is my son, Noah, bothering my mom. And so I remember that space and what an effect it had on being there and working there. In comparison to where the pot shop is now, the pot shop now is in a very functional space, but it wasn't designed to be a pot shop. It wasn't even designed to be inhabited by humans. It was actually the rock storage bin for a passive solar collection system that they tried to install on the backside of this building. One more Holden room before I go on to the next one is this one. And this one, too, I think has changed for the worse because of a lack of understanding, I think, about what architecture can do. Before this addition was added on to Koinonia, this was a symmetrical room that had its axis running this way. It's running right down the center of the building. There were six windows along that wall, three above and three below, that looked out into the woods. And the orientation of this room was like this. Usually the speaker sat here and people gathered around this way. And you can see that's the way the balcony is arrayed. There's kind of an awkwardness to this space now because in some senses it wants to be still oriented that way, but for other reasons we've all of a sudden turned it this way. The light's at our back now, so we kind of sit here. The other thing is there was a big flue that came down here, big hood, black hood, and there were usually fires going on in the fireplace when the sessions were going on. It was something of a distraction, true, in terms of delivering talks, but I think the atmosphere and the feeling that it gave to this room, and the sense of intimacy and gathering around the hearth, was a much stronger thing. The other one, very briefly, is the room that Anne and I first lived in when we got married. We moved to Paris, and I was studying at Atelier Disset, a printmaker studio in the 14th arrondissement, and Anne was lucky enough, she found an ad at the American Church in Paris for an English-speaking au pair, which is someone who takes care of kids, and the job came with a room. And so she called and asked if she could interview for the job, and oh, by the way, she was married, could we live together in the room? And sure enough, they allowed us to do that. And so we were on the seventh floor of this Parisian apartment building, 127 steps up. I described this in an earlier session. Some of you have already been here. Excuse me for the repetition. But the room was 7 feet wide. You could do this and touch, if you kind of did this, you could touch both walls without moving your feet. 14 feet long. It was tiny, cramped, teeny bed, a little gas burner. We did have running water. The bathroom was down the hall. But it was such an amazing space, not only because it's filled with memories for us, but because that teeny window on the outside became an enormous window on the inside, given the scale of the room. And it overlooked the rooftops of Paris. And so it kind of set the whole tone for our stay there. There was a gutter outside, and we kept a little orange crate, and that's where we kept milk and things that needed to stay cold. And the other thing is, if you leaned way over and looked to your left in this image, you could actually see the Eiffel Tower. So. In any case, let me get on with the
which window was yours?
The far one that I'm waving out of. You can see I'm up above here waving.
Oh.
Oh yeah.
There I am with longer hair and glasses. I want to talk a little bit about what architecture can do, the architectural task, and I'm going to use a model that was set up by a Norwegian architectural historian, Christian Norberg Schultz, and he talks about different tasks, and they're in ascending order of importance, and they start with the very physical and end with the spiritual, and the first one is the physical. Basically, buildings protect us from the environment, and the most rudimentary building would be a tent. And so here you can see some examples of tents. They keep the snow and the rain off, they keep the wind out, and we're actually able to generate a little heat in there, too, that doesn't escape. That can be translated to early vernacular buildings, and depending upon the elements that need to be protected from the form and the materials that are available, the form changes very radically. So here we have an early Swedish thatched-roofed house that's log cabin that's hunkered down and has very few windows because obviously cold was a very important environmental factor that one needed to be protected from. And so it's a compact form. It surrounds a little courtyard to create a little bit of a protected outdoor space. As opposed to, this is a little hut in Hong Kong, actually, in a little squatter's village in Hong Kong. It's made with just scrap pieces of material, wood, tin. You can see the tin shed is held in place with some bricks running along the ridge. It's really just thrown together, but it protects the inhabitant from the torrential downpours that'll happen in Hong Kong. Heat really isn't much of a problem. I'm not even sure that there's a window or a door. There are the openings, but I'm not really sure whether they actually close. It looks like, and there may be shutters. But in any case, it uses the available materials at hand. It's very simple, and it protects against the specific elements that one needs to be protected from. The next level the next role that a building can fulfill is a functional one. We build buildings for certain reasons, and those reasons require certain types of space. So here's a market in northern Sweden, and it's built as a long, linear building in which all these little market stalls can be set up. This one actually, as you would suspect, has several aisles. It's got one aisle right here, one down the center, and then I believe a third. And one of the important things that needs to happen here, in addition to just these long linear arcades that people can move down, is light. And so it's, the center bay is raised up. This is a basilica plan, basically, very much like a church, but it functions very well as a as an interior market. A school would be another example of sort of fulfilling certain functional requirements. A school would be proportioned very differently from a market. It's probably much more square in plan. And it needs to accommodate one person standing in front of several and talking, and again, sufficient light to operate by. This is in, Shenzhen, probably, in China. Light often is one of the main functional requirements that needs to be fulfilled, and this building doesn't give it away what it is immediately, but when you get inside of it, you realize what this large light-gathering element is. This is the surgical theater at the University of at Uppsala. And so the large dome, here's a shot of the inside of the dome, lights the main activity of the building, which is the demonstration of surgical procedures and the opening up of cadavers for all of the surgical students that sit around in a big, steeply raked circle. I don't even think there's, you just stand. Look at these forms. Everybody just kind of filed in and stood while the operation took place. That's my daughter Sonia having her diapers changed. As we move up the scale of importance, we get to social activities. And the way that buildings begin to reflect and shape social activities can be seen particularly in the way we build cities and towns. And so these are some of the row houses in Annapolis, Maryland. And I would suggest that they reflect a very different culture and a very different social structure than the courtyard houses in Beijing. everything here is on the street. You know, there's an alley back behind too, but they're just tight little thin rows of houses, and all of the activity occurs on the street. Whereas in Beijing, you can see the street, which is on the upper right-hand corner of that slide, seems rather desolate and empty. It's all walls with entries into these family compounds. And then the importance of the extended family, you know, generations of one family living around a courtyard is really revealed in the courtyard organization of the architecture. In a way, this building sort of, the city of Beijing starts almost as a solid, and it has carved out spaces, the courtyards and the streets, whereas this starts out as a void and begins to create building. This is much less dense than this. There are other kind of social activities that need to be shaped. For instance, in Charleston, the public market was a very important activity for that city. And so it's crowned with a Greek temple, and then the public market stretches out behind, and you can see it's even at the end of the street. So the importance of the public market to that particular culture is revealed in its architecture. I love this slide. This is way, way up in northern Sweden. I think it might be Luleå. I can't remember the town exactly. But it was a large church that served a great area. And of course, the snow is quite heavy up there, and so in the wintertime, it was often very difficult to get to church. So the farm families would leave the day before. They would travel to church and live in these little cabins. So a little miniature city was established outside the church, and everyone had their own little cabin, and they would stay there, go to church the next morning, and maybe stay another night or head right back again. So there's this miniature city that reflects that whole activity that I think is really marvelous. I wanted to show you a piece of new architecture, relatively new architecture, that I think begins to address those notions of social needs. I wanted to make sure I didn't get into ones that were strongly cultural. And so I took a private institution, actually, that almost in some ways wants to represent a microcosm of a city. Jonas Salk, who was the inventor of the polio vaccine, wanted to build a research institute in La Jolla, California. And he was a very strong-willed individual, and he didn't want to build any research institute. He wanted to build a community of scholars, a community of scientists that would live and work together, go to concerts, eat, and really kind of develop the camaraderie and the togetherness and that symbiotic relationship in which he thought scientific ideas would really flourish. And so he asked around, who's the best architect in America right now? This is 1960s. And someone mentioned Lou Kahn. Lou Kahn was a professor of architecture at the University of Pennsylvania and had already done a few things, including a Richards Medical Laboratory at the University of Pennsylvania. And Lou Kahn was also an extraordinarily strong-willed individual. So the story of these two titans clashing is an interesting one in architecture. And I've actually heard, I've never heard Lou Kahn. He died before I was interested in architecture. But I've heard disciples of Lou Kahn talk about that relationship. And I've also heard Dr. Jonas Salk talk about that relationship. And it's really interesting who takes credit for what, depending upon who you're listening to. But in any case, this is a building that I think does many things quite well, but it's very uncompromisingly modern. It's largely utilitarian, too. There are two wings of laboratories, and they are just gigantic, long blocks in which there are huge open floors with no columns, and the idea was then they could put any kind of equipment they wanted, arrange tables any way that they wanted. In order to do that, they had to have a great deal of structure. So there are floors in between each laboratory floor that are actually a giant concrete truss with holes in it. And so those aren't really occupied, but they represent the lungs of the building. And anytime they want to, they can get in there and run wires and run air and do all the kinds of things that allow the laboratory floors themselves to be totally flexible. Inside of those giant laboratory buildings are little office towers. And the towers almost stand like sentinels along the great courtyard that's in between. Here you can see a pretty good picture of the laboratory, the office towers on either side, and then the big space, the big grand square, the town square that Salk really envisioned this as being. So I'll just briefly look at this building. The laboratory towers are the ones that are the most outward looking. Obviously in the labs you're busy, you know, over your Bunsen burners or doing whatever you want to do. But when you come to your office, maybe you have a chance to look out, see what's going on in the courtyard. Maybe you come down and smoke a pipe with somebody on the bench, or you just look out at the ocean. And that's why all of these little towers have this funny little bent corner that allows a window to look right out over the Pacific Ocean. The materials are concrete, and then it's infilled in those most human of spaces with teak. So here are the laboratory towers. Here are the stairs between the labs and the offices. Liu Kahn decided that he didn't want the scientists to get too fat. So what he actually did was, here's a lab floor, here's one of those service floors. The office towers are actually occupied on the floors where the lab towers aren't. So whenever you're moving from your office to your lab, you have to move up the stairs and back down again, or maybe back up to another lab. So there's this really marvelous procession of movement between the office towers and the labs. And so here we are at the lab level, looking back through to the main courtyard. And here's the corridor that runs along the lab level. And you can see they're just big glass walls that are filled with whatever you like. Some marvelous vistas occur as you move through these spaces, as you move through the towers and toward the lab buildings. Here's on the ground courtyard level. And the way the light comes through, I think, is really beautiful. And then on one of the unoccupied levels of the office towers are open balconies where you can sit. And that, too, creates this marvelous view right through there when you get in the right place. So, but here's where all of that activity was meant to take place. And these are actually architects, not scientists. But you can imagine them with white lab coats on, I think, sitting around discussing great ideas. And finally, some comparisons I'd like to make. I think that in this case, Liu Kahn was really pretty successful in, from this side, breaking down the scale of this building into all these little individual pieces. So it's really not all that unlike a little town, particularly if it was, you know, full of activity. This, by the way, is, here he is. I got the picture of Dr. Jonas Salk crossing the great divide. But from the other side, there's a monumentality to this building that I think is really wonderful, particularly when juxtaposed up against the infinite Pacific Ocean. And I think the way that this building does two things, works at two completely different scales, one a very small human scale, and the other a large scale, it's almost as though, let's create a place that's really moving, really profound, and something that will last forever. And so I'd like to suggest that it's not all that unlike Stonehenge. And someday, 1,000 years from now, when all of the wood is gone and it's just these big concrete hulks, that there'll be still something really quite moving about this space. And so here are the kind of art photos. If you ever get to La Jolla and it's a nice day and it's near sunset, you should really go to this space. It's because you can walk right in, I believe, to this courtyard at least, and it's an amazingly moving space.
Peter, the buildings themselves with that concrete and the sharp angles and stuff almost gives it a cold, impersonal kind of a look when you look at it in the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a better, more human feel about it when you're there in person?
I think you do, and I think it's like the two buildings. On the one side, particularly from this side, it seems very massive and hard, but from the other side, where the teak really starts to stand out, I don't think it seems impersonal at all, particularly when it's full of people.
I'm thinking too, Peter, the concrete, the There's no trees, mm-hmm. of course, there's landscaping involved there. In Davis, California, University of California Davis campus is known for its all of the plants and trees that grow on that campus.
Uh-huh.
The climate is so conducive. And in the center, there's a building, a modern building, very similar to this, devoted to the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so striking that it's like this.
Uh-huh. But it seems really sterile.
It feels, like you're saying, it feels pretty concrete, cold, barren.
I think this doesn't, you know. And as I said, it's really when you get into it and then you begin to see all the wood and the teak and the there's a breakdown in scale. I don't think you would find this cold and barren. I think you need to go and see it.
Do you see people? I mean, are there people? People are standing at their windows or at their desk.
There were lots of people when I there were lots of people when I was there, but that's because it was full of architects. So I can't really say what it's like in its day-to-day operation. Dr. Salk really at the time was just sung its praises. There's an irony about the barrenness of this particular courtyard. Lawrence Halprin was the landscape architect for this job. He's a rather famous landscape architect. Lou Kahn actually wanted to plant. There's a grove of trees just outside of this, and he actually wanted to plant this with trees. And it was the landscape architect who actually said, "No, I think this wants to be just this wide open space." That really is much more like perhaps an Italian courtyard in the center of town, like Siena or somewhere, where it's all built rather than planted. So ironically enough, this is largely due to the landscape architect. Anyway, let me move on quickly. The last category, and I think the ones that we're often most interested in, is the cultural role that architecture can play. Architecture can talk about who we are, what we believe, what our history is, what our myths are, and that is embodied in only very few buildings. This happens to be the Stockholm City Hall, which is, if you ever get a chance to see it, is a marvelous building, and it's one of those buildings that I think begins to talk about a culture. Another one that I showed, and I'll show very briefly again because I showed it on Tuesday, is the Stockholm Public Library. The importance of this institution of learning to these people, I think, is made evident in the form and the story that this building tells. This was built in 1925. It's built right in the heart of Stockholm on Sveavägen, but it has a park to one side. As you walk along the street, there are some low buildings upon which the library sits, and you finally come to an opening, and these low, wide steps lead up to the main entry, which is a gigantic thing. And so already, the notion of the importance of this building is established. When you go up to grab onto the front door handle, it's Adam and Eve. Actually, you have to grab onto Eve to get into the building. You have to grab onto Adam to get out. I will tell you that these were getting so overused that they've now moved them to the side door of the building. They're still on the building. But, all of a sudden, here I am going into this repository of knowledge, and I'm reminded of the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Knowledge and eating of the fruit of the Tree of Knowledge. Entering further, you're in a dark entry hall. It's actually polished black plaster with Egyptian bas-reliefs on the sides. And again, what are we reminded of here? Is it kind of ancient history? In some ways, I'm reminded of a tomb. A pyramid. But obviously, there's something very sacred being stored here. And I begin to look up, and I can see another set of there's another huge doorway, although this one is much smaller in scale than the last, and I can begin to see the end of the journey, which is this gigantic cylindrical room in the center of the building. These great little curved stairs that begin to redefine the form of that cylinder lower down in the building. It almost carves out that same diameter so you can still understand from the inside the sort of notion of the big square and a cylinder that's jammed down into it, you can see a little bit better some of the Egyptian bas-reliefs and a little bit of the pattern on the doorway as well. And finally, I move up the stairs. There's a great light fixture also designed by the architect whose name was Gunnar Ostlund in the center. And I begin to see the room. And finally, up in the room, I'm in the world of knowledge. There are three tiers of books, and each of the tiers, this could be actually focused a little bit. And you want to try, or that's all right. All of the countries of the world are represented in gold letters along these bookcases. And so this represents a sampling of the collection. The true collection, this is a library that was built in 1925, and most of you know, libraries in 1925, the whole collections weren't available to the public. Most of the collection is actually down below. And there's a little book elevator, a little dumbwaiter, in the circulation desk, which sits in the very center of the cylinder. And when you told them what book you wanted, they sent the little note down. And in this whole lower level is a series of radiating book stacks from the center. And so they would go down and get your book. Someone would be down there getting your book and send it back up to you. So this was really the room where you, what do you call it? Delivery room. I think a lot of early American libraries had what was known as the delivery room. But it was also just the room to symbolize the importance of this library. The reading rooms are actually off to the side. Oops, let me see, let me try this one. Oops, I guess I don't have it. The reading rooms are actually off to the side, and they're beautiful long spaces where you actually would feel much more comfortable reading than here. This is just a building that's all about this universe that's created, the universe of knowledge, and then the importance of that. The other interesting thing that is that this really represents the top edge of the building, or one could imagine that it does. And I think that if Ostlund could have, if he had lived in a sunnier climate where it never rains, I think he would have left off the whole top of the building. And you would have been surrounded by books and looking up at the sky, because this is the sky. Look at the way the plaster is actually textured to look like clouds. And there it is again. So some of the cultural values that we transmit are about what we respect and what we value. The other cultural values that we transmit are religious, and of course, this is Uppsala Cathedral, and it begins to talk about the sacred things that we hold most dear. At this point, I want to move to St. Ignatius Chapel. Like, in a way, we've been leading up to that all the way along, because I think it's a building that moves us, that transmits values about what we believe in an entirely unique and modern way. First I want to show one more modern church that does things in a more traditional way. There's a wonderful architect in Sweden whose name is Carl Norén, and he's done a series of beautiful churches, mostly for what's known in this country as the Covenant Church, which is a branch off of the Lutheran Church. What is it called in Sweden then? The Mission Church. Yeah. And so this is one that's outside I think this is actually in Uppsala too. A mission church designed by Carl Norén. And you can see he uses some very traditional materials, but it's not a traditional church. And so a lot of board and batten siding, the tile roof. You don't enter in an all traditional way. You kind of skirt along the side of the main sanctuary, come under the front porch, enter the doors through a vestibule and another set of doors, although actually I think this is looking back out the other way. And finally you arrive at the sanctuary, which is made cheaply. Inexpensive wooden trusses holding up the roof, a lot of wood, a tile floor, just a large space. The light fixtures are also designed by the architect. But I think it's a space that Well, I know it's a space that's quite inspiring and moving, and one that is conducive to worship. What's really great is some of the big blue lamb beams are painted with church history. And I'm not sure if this is St. Francis being represented here, but what I like most about it is at the very end, there's actually a little painting of the church itself. So church history is conveyed all the way up to the very present. The baptismal font. Carl Moran loves to work with this painter who paints in a rather naive style, and it really creates a sense of folk tradition and a continuity of the tradition, particularly in these fairly modern spaces. But what I want to show you is something a little bit more radical than that. I want to show you the St. Ignatius Chapel. If any of you are, and this is a stark building, I happen to really like the interior, the outside of this building, and I think it's the kind of building, just like the Ugly Duckling, that you would come to love. I think the buildings that we actually like the outsides of are ones that we're familiar with, and ones that have a certain sense of scale and tactility to them. I think this building has that, but it's hard for a lot of people. There's a lot of interesting stories about how, as the supporters of this university and benefactors of this chapel saw it going up, they were really quite horrified and didn't know what they'd gotten into. But when they finally went inside, all of their worries were washed away.
This is in
Seattle. It's on the Seattle University campus. Are any of you from Seattle or going to Seattle? Seattle University campus. It's on Madison. If you were to take Madison towards downtown and hit about 12th, there's a little entry into campus that's right. I mean, this is Madison literally going by. Was just completed this spring by an architect whose name is Stephen Hall, who actually is a resident of, was born and raised in Bremerton, but now works in New York City. But let me just talk to you a little bit about this chapel. It's St. Ignatius, and the initial idea or metaphor that Stephen Hall got was a gathering of different lights. And a gathering of different lights refers to the mission of Seattle University, but also St. Ignatius's vision of the spiritual life. And he said it comprises many interior lights and darknesses, consolations and desolations. And so the notion of gathering in different lights from different places was an early inspiration for this building. And here's Stephen Hall often communicates ideas with little watercolors, and I'm sure this watercolor is probably no larger than this. As a matter of fact, you can see the writing here. And he decided to create 7 bottles of light, and each one would relate to a different aspect of worship. And so we have the daily procession of Mass, the Blessed Sacrament, the choir, the altar. Can anybody read that? I can't. Well, gathering and something else. And he already had a physical idea for the building, which would be, you'll see in a moment, it sits in a fairly constrained location. So it would be a simple box of stone, it ended up being concrete, with these light gathering elements that would bring in different colors of light from different directions of the sky. Here's a site plan to orient you. So here's Madison Street going down to downtown. Downtown is right down there. And here's the campus of Seattle University. This is actually a large parking lot, but it'll soon be another building. And here's the chapel. And so this picture is taken from somewhere down on this path. This path is the major thoroughfare through the campus. And so we're looking down this path along the side of the building and to Madison Street. And so because of its location and situation along the path, the architect put the entry right here. So it was in the front of the chapel, but also right at the edge of that path. And here you can see it in this picture. The entry is marked by the doors, the cutaway of the building, and also this huge light gathering element above it. The building is actually made out of a very simple and cheap method. It's called a tilt-up concrete construction, and the only, most of the buildings that are made with tilt-up concrete construction are warehouses, because it's very easy to do. you cast the gigantic slab of the warehouse, and then you cast the walls right on the floor. You create some little side walls, put in the rebar, the reinforcing steel, and then you pour it in place. And, oh, by the way, before you did that, you put a little releasing agent down so your wall didn't stick to your floor. But then a big crane comes along, and there are certain hook points that have been embedded in the wall. It's picked up, tipped up into place, anchored below, and there you have it. Stephen Hall did that with this building, and so each of these panels was cast on the floor of the sanctuary once that was cast, and then tipped up into place. Although typically with warehouses, they're big rectilinear forms, and in this case, it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle, and you can start to follow the lines of each piece of the tilt-up puzzle and how it was set into place. These little blobs on the walls are actually hook point covers. Usually, you put the hook points where the wall is lifted up into place on the inside so they don't show. But one of the things that this building is about is the materials themselves. And so, in this case, there was a desire to really show how these walls were made. And so, he put the hook points on the outside and then covered them with little covers that we'll see in a moment. We'll get to the inside of the building soon. I know some of you are really anxious for that. Here's a close-up again, and then what you begin to see as you follow this path, or in my case, I'm coming from Madison, are some cast glass windows in the side of this building, and it begins to set up a certain anticipation for what's going to happen inside. These windows represent the five aspects, let's see, they represent, St. Ignatius was the head of the Franciscans.
No, Jesuits.
The Jesuits. And these windows represent, now I have theologians in my audience, and I have to get
them. It's your facts, right?
Hold on. I don't think I'm going to find it. Let me try one more source and then I won't dally. It has something to do with Jesuit worship. Oh, here we go. They represent the spiritual exercises. Conversion, God's indwelling, Christ's laboring, and resurrection. Here are the hook point covers. St. Ignatius had a major spiritual experience while he was on a pilgrimage to Rome at the River Cardoner. And there's a lot of water, well, obviously there are many water there are many references to water in a lot of the Christian gospel, but there are many references to it in this building as well. As they were trying to come up with a hook point cover, they couldn't get a shape that they liked, and they finally found this old buoy in a junk store somewhere. And you can actually see the wood grain on this. This hook point cover is actually cast from an old wooden buoy. Some of the ways that the tilt-up concrete walls come together are quite beautiful. The outside then has been rubbed with a stain called Roman ochre, and depending upon the density of the concrete, it takes it differently. So you can see this panel takes it quite differently from here, and it sets up a marvelous texture.
Dean, what is hook point covering?
That's covering the places where the crane hook would hook into the embedded piece of steel to lift it up. So now let's go into the building. Anne, could you try and focus that? That's really bad. Do you know where the focus button is? The doors are carved out of yellow Alaskan cedar, and they're actually hand adds, so these doors have a very heavy texture to them. They have seven windows in there, so again, it refers to the seven bottles of light. There they are, a little bit closer. The door handles are custom designed, and they're made out of reddened bronze. The interesting thing about the doors is the one, both cathedrals would have gigantic doors, and then in the gigantic doors would be smaller doors for people to enter, and the large doors were only opened at great celebrations, at great events or the times of the year. There's a similar thing going on here, where there's a person door that you can enter individually, but when there is a big wedding or a great event being held in the chapel, the larger door opens up. Or there they are both open. There's the door handles. They're just, they have a marvelous feel to them. And they remind me of a stole, yeah. When you enter the door, here you are. Here is that wall that you passed by if you came in from Madison. Here are the four cast glass windows again. And you can see actually all the way, we're going to eventually go up into the sanctuary and into the Chapel of the Blessed Sacrament. Here's the baptistry, the baptismal font right here. But before we do that, look back at the doors and then at the bell tower and the reflecting pond. And look over to the side. Let me back this up a second. There we go. These four, five paintings were commissioned to commemorate the life of St. Ignatius, and of course at Seattle University, what they really want to commemorate is his time at the University of Notre Dame. So there he is with his book. And now we'll come around and look at the narthex, which is off to the side. The first thing is there's a large glass window, and it allows you to look back and connect to the university. And here's that main pedestrian way with a car on it through the university. And the quality of light that these walls give off is created by the texturing of the plaster. The walls are just sheetrock. They're just, but then the plasterer came in and the architect came in, and the architect said, well, I want some jaggy patterns. And so they played around a little bit, and the plasterer said, well, how about this? And the architect looked at it and said, yeah, that looks pretty good. But because what he wanted was this mottled quality of light coming in. So all of the walls have this amazingly beautiful texture to them that not only bring in the light in a certain way, but they also reveal the plaster on the walls. And again, it's all about, at the one time you want to do, you want to have the material do more than it physically can. Yet at the same time, one of the tenets of modern architecture is really to show the materials for what they are. And I think this material, this building does a good job of doing both, and that's a good example of it, I think. The floors are polished concrete. Here's a large rug that basically represents that experience that Ignatius had at the River Cardoner, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right. Here are the four windows again. The slow ramp that leads up to the sanctuary. This was taken before they had a Bible in place. Some of the details are really beautiful. I'm going to look at just the detail right here. The way the piece of metal that forms the ramp comes down and folds around this rail and finally is bolted into the ground, almost as though you could have taken it and twisted it around yourself and bolted it to the ground. So that's what I'm talking about in terms of a directness of the use of materials. The windows from the inside and from the outside. And finally, we'll move up into the sanctuary. As you move up, you can see the sanctuary to the right, and then also what is almost at the end of the axis is the Chapel of the Blessed Sacrament and the, what is this called where the host is kept?
Tabernacle.
The what?
Tabernacle.
I don't think that's it.
Librarium?
It's where the host is kept after a service, and then it's taken to the infirm and the
tabernacle.
The tabernacle?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the tabernacle, and it's actually an onyx box. But in any case, let's look at the baptismal font. carved again out of Alaska yellow cedar. It's set up against a frosted glass window that brings light in it. It's brass on the inside, and you can see this little thing right here. It's actually slightly swirling. There's a little jet underneath this form at the bottom, and the water is always moving. And then the oils for baptism, confirmation, and healing are in a special case that sit up against that window. Finally, you arrive at the sanctuary, and it's hard to describe. It's a series of vaulted spaces that blend into one another with light coming in different places. It's really formed by these seven gathering light elements, and each one brings in a different kind of light. For instance, here's the altar, and this light baffle is painted bright yellow on the back side of it. So the light from the clear windows comes into it, and it bounces that bright yellow light against the walls of the sanctuary. At the same time, there's a little blue light that light comes in directly through because it's in this slot. So at various times of the day, you'll get the cast of yellow on the walls. And then look right here. The light from the lens will come in a slightly different way. So the way the light moves through this place is absolutely amazing. I've been in there 3 or 4 times now, and the light is never the same. Each one of these bottles of light is different every time you come in.
Basic shape there with the buttressing, it reminds me of some of the what they call them, the cathedrals in Europe.
Down below.
Not the catacombs, but down below.
Yeah.
Like in Canterbury or something like that. The buttress support reminding of an entombed deep, dark place.
It's a really small space, and one of the ways that Stephen Hall tries to make it bigger is that nothing is really closed off. Even you'll see the confessional chapel is somewhat connected by virtue of light from up above. And the narthex is actually, you can see part of the narthex through this slot in the chapel there. The ambo, I think that's what they call the place from which the scripture is read and from which the sermon is given, is made of red and bronze again, and in this case it's ash. And again, it's very modern. It's a very direct use of materials, but I think quite beautiful at the same time. Here's a nice example. You can almost sense, here you can see some of the regular windows, and they come up against this bright yellow painted wall and then bounce down onto the wall behind. There's another shot, actually, of the outside. There's the outside of the same thing. And here you can see that wall. Again, looking back towards the narthex, with the narthex right behind there. This is the little confessional chapel, the Chapel of Reconciliation, and we'll look at that in a moment. From another corner, I apologize for these pictures. It was really difficult to take pictures in here. But again, this is where the baptismal font was. Here's the back aisle of the church, and there's the Chapel of the Holy Sacrament. And this is going inside of it. The interesting thing about the Chapel of the Holy Sacrament is that there's this piece of a madrona tree that sits in the middle of it, and from which an incense candle, a votive candle sits. And again, here the light is orange and blue, and so the orange cast on the walls, and occasionally the blue light coming directly through. There are various verses and quotes and poems that are inscribed in the walls. But the most amazing thing when you walk into the Chapel of the Blessed Sacrament is the smell of wax. It's the smell of candles burning, and it's a smell that oftentimes in architecture we deal with only visual cues. But there are other cues, and one of them is smell. And it turns out that the smell of wax is not just from the votive candle burning, but the whole walls have been coated with wax from about 8 feet down. And so as you read these quotes, you're reading them through a layer of wax. I am not sure how they do it because it's textured, it's like dripped wax. But that smell completely changes your perspective. It really kind of, something different is going on here. It changes you somehow. And again, all of the furniture is very simply designed. This is in the choir. This is actually one of the nicest pictures I have of the way the light works, because here the baffle is painted green on the back side, and the lens, the window that allows light in directly, is orange. And so here you can begin to see an example. This was taken just as the little orange light was beginning to form on the walls, and here you can see it more completely formed. Finally, we'll move into the Chapel of Reconciliation, which is through this door here. As I said, it too is even connected to the main space by virtue of the volumes up above. So there's a little window that separates the two, but volumetrically it is also connected. This is a great picture because you can really see how everything is connected. This is taken from the Chapel of the Blessed Sacrament. You can see the Chapel of Reconciliation, the main sanctuary, and you can actually look all the way out along the processional way to the main door. The door is huge, and it actually turns the corner. But it sits on a pivot right here, and it opens very easily. So it's almost as though half of the wall of the chapel opens up. And when you do open it up, you see the inside. The inside is quite small. It's probably, it may be 6 feet square, maybe 7 feet square, but it's amazingly high, and you can look up and again see this light coming in.
Looking what back. What was the sort of, it looked like a leopard's skin or something.
It's just a weaving. Actually, I haven't ever read anything or asked about it. It's a weaving of some kind, and I'm not sure. It's the screen. Isn't this the screen that separates the...
Well, for confession.
Yeah, for confession.
Yes, it is.
So I think this kind of folds out, and the priest sits behind.
They can do it seated.
Yeah.
Not
I think it's variety, you know, in this day and age of choice. You probably have your choice of how you want to confess. But it's amazing space because you get in there, and like I said, it's very small, but the light washing in from way up high is just awesome. Here's the back, here's the door from the other side. A little light, they have technological innovations, a little light comes on. There's actually a little switch that you push when you get inside, so there's a little light on the outside so you'll know that it's in use. Every detail of the building is carefully crafted and built by actually local artisans. The wall sconces are these heavy cast glass again, and I love the way that they're just held by these little reddened brass fingers that reach around them. So, I want you all to go see this building if you ever get to Seattle, but I also want to leave you with a sense that modern architecture can create environments to enhance whatever our activity is. And if our activity is worship, then I think that architecture really has the power to make that experience more profound. Right at a certain time of the day, too. I don't know if they tried to figure it out so that it would be during the time when the service is held, but this flash of sunlight comes shooting in against this wall and really starts revealing the texture of that wall. Beautiful thing. So, there it is. Does anyone have any questions about the building or about anything else that I've discussed? Yeah.
Two questions. Number one, did the architect design all the fittings and the furniture that go through that, or was he sub that out to somebody?
He did. And the interesting thing is we don't have a tradition of that in this country, although particularly in the Scandinavian countries, The architect was responsible for much more. Oftentimes, the architect would design the light fixtures, would design the chairs, would design the furniture. We tend to specialize, and that's getting to be even more the case in the Scandinavian countries, particularly Finland, where they still have a larger role, but they're losing it. But it allows for this unified vision of things. And as I said, particularly when you start out with an idea, a gathering of different lights, to be able to convey that in every element of the architecture, I think, is something that's important, and it's not often achieved.
Second question is, how in God's green earth do you get a contractor to cooperate in building with that thing?
I don't know. I know the company, you wouldn't have ever heard of it, but they actually take extraordinary pride in this building.
After it's done, yeah. I'm saying, but going in.
Well, can you imagine, just from a technical standpoint, this was all designed and modeled. Because how do you draw? How do you draw this? You know, what kind of architectural drawing can you use to convey this? So the whole building was really designed in model form, and then they had to try and translate that into drawings. And I'm not sure whether they used computer techniques or whatever, but each one of these vaults, of course, has structure within it, and it's all curved tube steel. And each one of those pieces of tube steel had to be curved to a certain radius. I do think that this is one example where computerization really was used to its fullest advantage. But to my knowledge, the relationship remained remarkably good throughout the process.
Of course, they're getting paid. No, that's not the way contracting works.
No.
Yeah, Duane.
Dieter, do you work in design of sacred architecture? Sacred?
I never have. Because of the nature of my work, I do residential work because that's all I really have the capacity for while teaching. But I think worship spaces are architectural dream jobs because that's where you begin to have a client who understands more of the roles of architecture besides the physical and functional. So they are always the best of spaces.
I appreciate it. What fascinates me here is, you know, the use of orientation and light. You know, and that because you do that in residential, they do. That's very important in northern climates or any climate.
There's so many different elements, different images. It's not just modern. It's such a mixture, so many different.
Well, I think modern has gotten a bad rap because it's come to be associated with a particular kind of architecture. But actually, I think the way that Stephen Hall works is with a clean slate every time. It's very difficult to do, and there are very few architects that can pull it off, but it's almost as though some idea finally has to emerge that's the guiding idea. But really, start without any preconceptions, modern or otherwise, and begin to think about what needs to happen, what is the spirit or the essence of this space, and what can be made of, how can we do it?
Don't you think price often drives a design too? I mean, if they had all the money in the world, could they have done those formed concrete walls?
They could have. I mean, they could have done something else.
Yeah.
I think that economics is a factor early on in a piece of architecture, but I think that you can make beautiful architecture with very tight constraints on economic factors. Like Karl Norén's churches, I think that they're very inexpensively built, and I think they're very beautiful too. So it's just a factor that needs to be considered early on. Actually, I think that almost sometimes the worst things happen when the budget is unlimited.
Yeah.
To be honest, the cost goes up so radically when you have a poor design, because you constantly have to adapt, adjust, overbuild to compensate for something that doesn't fit in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's good. Maybe away from this, but you know that I've seen both the Oslo and the Stockholm City Hall, and I mean, you get to there, you get goosebumps just by coming near them, and you step inside it even more. What is that about that? The Scandinavia has produced these public buildings that are so awesome, and inviting. Same time.
I'm not sure what it is, but I think it's somehow a greater understanding on the part of the people about what architecture can do, and that kind of allows them to empower architects to do those things. Because you're right, that's a great description. I think that we ought to get goosebumps more often when we go into buildings.
Well, public buildings, I mean, these are city halls.
Library. Have you been to the library?
The library, yes. I
got goosebumps going to that library, and I could just imagine, and I said this before on an earlier session, but I could just imagine taking a six-year-old by the hand and leading them up those steps and finally having them experience that just kind of world of books when they finally get up there and they're surrounded by these three tiers of books from all over the world.
Where is that?
That's in Stockholm.
Well, again, that's the city library.
Yes, the Stockholm. Oh, one more story and then I'll quit. Actually, they had never had a public library in Sweden before. And so Gunnar Östlund came to America to look at Carnegie libraries, because we had a system of public libraries already beginning in this country. And that was the first one. So that even makes it more profound to all of a sudden say, here we're making this knowledge available to the citizens of Stockholm, and we're putting it in, you know, a building that I think is equal to that gift. Well, thank you very much for coming.